its current state on 90.5 WKAR and AM 870. A new book with a Michigan co-author takes on a bleak subject, The Americans Who Live with No Regular Income. And current state's Melissa Benmark has more. Hi, Melissa.
Mark, this book has already been getting a lot of attention in The Atlantic, a favorable review in the Sunday New York Times. It's called $2 a Day Living on Almost Nothing in America. And one of the authors is a University of Michigan Associate Professor of Social Work and Public Policy. His name is Luke Schaefer. When I spoke with him last week, I asked him how he came to write the book with his co-author, Catherine Eden.
When we first met, she told me that she thought she had been going into more and more homes, having been doing this for 20 years, where people didn't just have not enough, especially cash income, to survive. They had nothing at all, and she wanted to see, was there an increase in the number of families surviving on very low levels of cash income in particular? And I had been working with data, particularly a data set administered by the Census Bureau that is not perfect, but registers the most income among the poor. And so we decided to see, had there been any increase in this data source? And we used a $2 a day threshold, sort of borrowed it as a marker of very low levels of income. You know, what we found, we thought, was quite striking. And that's what led us to actually go back into the field together. We released an initial report, and it got a lot of attention. But a lot of the questions we were being asked, we really could only answer by going out and finding families. You know, what happened that families ended up in these circumstances? How long was a spell of extreme poverty? And what did families do to survive? So the book really tells the stories of about 8 different families who we've been tracking for the last couple of years, doing interviews with them. And Kathy and I have both visited with all of them a couple of times each, and just seeing what happens in their daily lives.
You said you borrowed the $2 a day level. My understanding is that that's a level of poverty that's so low that it's really below even what the U.S. government considers extreme poverty. So, for instance, do you have an idea of where else in the world, for example, people might be trying to live off of less than $2 a day by way of comparison?
This is a marker that the World Bank uses to capture global poverty. We use it in particular to focus on cash income. So in the United States, it's our argument that you simply need a little bit of cash, a little bit of money to make it from day to day. And the stories that we see among our families is one of doing whatever they have to, selling blood plasma, selling sex when absolutely necessary, to get that little bit of cash. And we want to be clear that there are very important programs out there that provide some non-cash support to low-income families. So when you look at a program like SNAP, what a lot of people think of as food stamps, it cuts the number of families below this threshold considerably and is obviously playing an important role. But there's just something about cash in the United States that you need to survive. And even when you include food stamps in the equation, we're moving in decidedly the wrong direction. In other parts of the global world, there's actually a barter economy. It's easier to go from day to day without ever having cash income. And so we think there's some sort of important differences between what's going on here and what's going on there. Although, when we started to look into it, actually, you know, you start to look at direct measures of well-being, things like life expectancy and infant mortality. People often have the perception that poverty in the United States is different from poverty in some of the world's poorest countries. And when you start to look at these direct measures of well-being, that gets a lot less clear. And we were really struck by the ways that some disadvantaged groups in the United States have outcomes that don't look that different from some of the world's poorest countries.
You do this for a living. You study poverty and poverty programs for a living. What was it like being in the field with people who are living on that kind of money every day?
Well, when I got into this project, I was really a data nerd. I had spent most of my career gleaning what we could about how programs work using big nationally representative surveys or other sources of data. So this was a new and profound experience for me. I often tell people that I sometimes, from spending a day in the field, I would learn as much about poverty in America from talking to families for a day as I had learned in 3 months of looking at data. You learn more about how programs actually work out in people's lives and how people survive what it's like. And it wasn't easy. I have to say that, the first day, Kathy was really the trained ethnographer, so she had been in Chicago for a summer, and I went down to meet with the families who she'd been talking to, and I sort of did, every family in succession over the course of about 2 days, and it was brutal. I mean, I went back to my hotel room and cried. But there was something very powerful about it, too, to make connections. The way that we set up our interviews would often involve just people telling us their stories. And that was a really powerful experience for me.
Why are there, in the most affluent country in the world, why are there this many desperately poor people?
I think there's at least two major pieces as far as we're concerned. One is a major policy shift we made in the 1990s in Washington. We actually did a lot of really good things in the 1990s to make work pay. We expanded some tax credits that have the effect of boosting people's wages who are low-income working parents with kids. But we also had a welfare reform in 1996 that made cash assistance, what a lot of people think of as welfare, far less accessible. And in fact, the way the program is set up, it actually creates incentives for state programs to keep their welfare caseloads down. Since that time, those caseloads have plummeted, and that's directly related to what we're seeing in the field. The other big piece of it is the state of our low-wage labor market. I was surprised when we got into this work to find that the families who we interviewed, and again, we would consistently see evidence of this in the data we would go back to, the nationally representative data, that these families really thought of themselves as workers, had had a history of work, and wanted to be working again. But the jobs that were available to them were unstable and volatile and in so many respects that they found it extremely difficult to maintain them. The jobs that are available often have unsafe working conditions. We saw a lot of examples where families just couldn't get enough work hours, actually. You'd see a lot of volatile schedules from week to week. These things all sort of combined to create lots of barriers to maintaining work. And coupled with that were the family lives of folks. And a lot of times the people in their lives who might provide support were not just unsupportive, but part of the problem.
Why do you think that so many Americans are resistant to the idea that there is anybody that poor who lives here, sort of the welfare queen concept,
mm-hmm.
or that people are poor just because they're lazy?
Well, it's interesting to look at the data we have about what people think about the poor. When you ask Americans, should we do more to help the poor, a majority say yes. When you ask, should we offer more welfare, a majority say no. I think that the cash assistance program itself it cuts against some core American values, and so people really aren't supportive of it. I think also sort of the notion that there are people who are struggling to the extent that definitely the families we know are struggling, it's hard to deal with, right? It's hard to think that that's something that we let happen here, and I guess probably a final piece is it has to do with the stratification of society, right? When we're so separated that people in the middle class often don't come into contact. You could go about your daily life sort of never coming in contact with one of your fellow citizens who's in, conditions like this. It sort of leads people to believe it's not out there, but it is.
Well, Luke Schaefer, thank you very much for talking to us today. We appreciate it.
Yeah, my pleasure.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.